Most people voluntarily, though perhaps not consciously, give up their freedom because they are offered some convenience in return. One of the hardest things that I found to do is to be able to get a driver's license without leaking your home address. That's how they get you with the carrot and the stick, right? If you don't give up some of your freedoms in some way or another, you're not going to have the ability to do other things. When you're implementing strong privacy and security upfront, you don't necessarily get the feel-good feedback that you are stopping the bad guys. You don't see the attacks that fail. I have no idea how many people I have successfully thwarted from finding where I live because I don't see their failed research. Over, the course of human history, the adoption of freedom technology or lack thereof is going to have massive effects upon the trajectory of human civilization. I'm definitely more worried about losing my privacy than losing my reputation. I could disappear tomorrow and I would be fine.
All views expressed by the host or guests are solely their own opinions. Nothing stated in this podcast should be considered a specific endorsement to make any particular investment or follow any specific strategy.
Welcome back to All in Bitcoin, Jameson. I'm excited to talk to you about Bitcoin, freedom tech, and more. Last time we talked about liberty. Now let's talk about the tools and platforms that help us protect it. What does liberty look like to you, and where does it come from?
Well, liberty is the ability to do and say things without having others aggress upon you or harm you. The essence of voluntarism or anarchy, whatever you want to call it, should be that if I have ownership over myself, whether that's my body, my speech, what have you, then I should be able to do or say whatever I want as long as I am not infringing upon someone else's liberty. But that can become very tricky, especially in situations where perhaps there's a common or good or shared resource, or there is a dispute over, where are the actual boundaries of property? There's a lot of gray areas.
And where does it come from?
Yeah, ultimately, I think that it is property ownership, right? Property rights, and the most base of property rights should be that you own yourself and your physical body and your mind and what you say.
How are people's freedoms most effectively taken away today?
I would say most people voluntarily, though perhaps not consciously, give up their freedom because they are offered some convenience in return for doing so. And this is true for many aspects of our lives. A trivial example would be driving. If you want to drive, normally you have to go through some sort of process to, get a license from the state in order to have the privilege of driving on roads. And that process, in and of itself, is what I've found to be one of the most invasive when it comes to privacy. So, one of the hardest things that I found to do is to be able to get a driver's license without leaking your home address, for example. And at least in America, they've gone even further than that, with a program they call Real ID. They have enforced this at the airport level, where I think it just really started getting enforced in the past few months. So they were warning us for the past 10 years that it was going to happen, where if you want to be able to fly, they're going to require you to have a real ID, even just to fly within the confines of the United States. You need to have this enhanced level of identification. And to get that enhanced federal approved level of identification, you have to provide even more information when you're getting your license than you do just to get the state level. Long story short, I don't have a real ID. I just use my passport everywhere. That's how they get you, with the carrot and the stick, right? If you don't give up some of your freedoms in some way or another, you're not going to have the ability to do other things. I was actually having a conversation about this just the other day. It was actually coming up in the context of the knots versus core debate stuff and some of the rhetoric that is used. And whenever authoritarians are claiming that you need to give up some of your freedoms or your privacy or your security, it often comes down to one or two things, which is, of course, the most extreme scenarios that they can come up with: terrorism or the children, and, you know, child abuse and so on and so forth. It's like, we have to enforce these authoritarian, invasive control programs to make sure that we catch the terrorists, or to make sure that we catch the pedophiles, or what have you. And if you're against that, if you don't want to stop the terrorists, if you don't want to stop the pedophiles, you're a terrible person. And there is no argument. Like, game over, right? And some of those same rhetoric have now come up, you know, in the Bitcoin ecosystem, and debating about stuff. And I'm like, do you people not pay attention? Like, you're literally just using the same cookie cutter argumentation that authoritarians have been using to try to strip away our rights for many decades now.
Guys, I've got a quick favor to ask. If you are listening right now, take a second and hit subscribe and the bell if you are on YouTube, or follow on your podcast app so you don't miss the episodes and guests that matter to you. If we've ever given you value, this is the moment to give it back. It's free, it takes 2 seconds, and it genuinely helps keep improving every single episode. And to everyone already following, thank you. You are the reason we've been able to raise the bar. Your support, whether it's a donation, a comment, or subscribing, helps these conversations reach further. It also gives us the push to keep going, keep traveling, keep preparing, and keep bringing you in-person conversations like this. Thank you. Does it look like we are ready to defend our liberty? How distracted are we?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are very few people who are paying attention to the liberty aspects of anything that's going on in the world. I mean, it's tough in America. You know, I'm not very well versed with other political systems and their own parties and fighting, but the way that the primarily two-party system in America is set up is that the different parties are totally split when it comes to liberty issues. The Democratic Party can be pro-liberty in some areas, like drugs, for example. They tend to be more amenable to people not being put in a cell because they decided to do what they wanted with their own body. But then the Republicans tend to be anti-drugs and say, no, you can't do what you want with your own body, and we are going to put you in a cell. And then, of course, I mean, there's just dozens of these issues where the side that is pro-liberty is not always the same side. And so when you, as a libertarian, are presented with a system with this weird kind of mix up of the liberty issues, yeah, I mean, you can go vote for the Libertarian Party. And I did that a few times until I became so disillusioned. I was like, the entire system is rigged and stacked against a party that focuses on liberty. And they're doing things at the highest levels to prevent the Libertarian Party from actually becoming a serious contender. And so I opted out of even participating in that political system because I didn't think that it was worth my time or resources.
Mm-hmm. What are your personal red lines, and how do you protect them?
I mean, you know, you have the fundamental ideals, right? So for me, I try to base the root of all of my morals and philosophy is in the non-aggression principle, and try to remain as logically consistent as possible with that. But kind of as I alluded to earlier, there are gray area issues where it's not black and white. And sometimes there isn't a clear line. A good example of that would be the abortion issue. And this is one of the issues where even like within the liberty community, it's highly controversial. And so, you know, from one perspective of the abortion issue is, well, you cannot ethically abort a fetus because you're aggressing upon another human being and you're committing murder, and you know that's immoral. A flip side of this is the mother actually has it's not so much that the mother has the right to abort the fetus. Well, from a liberty principle, the fetus is a parasite. Like, it cannot live without the sustenance of the mother, and the mother is not ethically obligated to continue providing that necessary resource if they don't want to. But then, I would say the major problem with this whole debate, and the reason why I don't think you can objectively say one way or another, is that we don't have an objective way of defining a human, right? Is a fetus a human, or at what point does it become a human? This is where the debate becomes like, oh, it's when it has a heartbeat, or no, it's when it can start to feel pain, or, I mean, there's any number of arbitrary lines that you can try to set there, but I don't think any of them are like objective and have consensus built around them. So,
yeah, I understand what you're saying. In your case, what would be a red line for you, and how do you protect it?
There are many, many red lines. I mean, so a more recent example, if we just look at it in the context of engaging in rational discourse with people. I believe that, you know, you should generally assume good faith by whoever you're speaking with until you receive information that indicates otherwise. And so one red line that I've actually only just implemented recently is that if someone accuses me of operating in bad faith, or like they accuse me of being paid off, and that I like I'm my they question my incentives, that's a red line for me. I'm like, okay, then there's no point in us continuing this conversation because you don't believe that I'm engaging in good faith. So why should I bother engaging in good faith with you?
Yeah. What are the best freedom tools and platforms for you, and why?
Mostly, I would say this comes down to privacy, because I mean, as most libertarians, I'm a big fan of firearms, but that's a more theoretical thing, right? It's just like I am not currently using firearms to defend my my freedom, but I may someday need to. But it's more of a, you know, insurance policy on a day-to-day basis. And use of tools, I would say privacy is the big one. And so using things like VPNs, or using you know, email services that have better privacy and track records. That's even coming down to the operating system on my phone, running Graphene OS instead of running your a stock Android or stock iOS, just because, you know, operating systems are incredibly complicated and they have many things built into them that leak your information. And it happens, you know, completely opaquely in the background. You're often not even aware that it's happening. Everything from like the hardware that I use to the software that I run on the hardware. In general, using open source projects, I think, is one way to give yourself more freedom and privacy. Because open source projects, they don't have the same incentives. They're most likely not looking to collect your information and sell it. Because in many cases, not all cases, but in many cases, open source projects don't have like a for-profit company behind them that has that profit motive. Unfortunately, beyond that, you're normally going to have more friction. Like, it's the user experience is unfortunately going to be worse, and that's one of the trade-offs that you have to make.
Can you share one occasion you used them to defend your freedom?
Well, I mean, I do it on a daily basis, really. This is the tricky thing, is that when you're implementing strong privacy and security upfront and then operating from a strong position, you don't necessarily get the feel good feedback that you are stopping the bad guys, so to speak, because it's automatic. It's happening. You're not aware of it. Like, you don't see the attacks that fail. All of the privacy protections that I put in place to make sure that people can't find where I live, I have no idea how many people I have successfully thwarted from finding where I live, because I don't see their failed research.
This episode is brought to you by Bitbox, the Swiss-built Bitcoin hardware wallet that guards your sovereignty. I use Bitbox because it's fully open source, easy to use, and I can plug it into my phone. If you need a hardware wallet to keep your Bitcoin off exchanges, offline, and safe, go to bitbox.swiss/allinbitcoin for 5% off, or use the code allinbitcoin, or check the show notes. A myth about freedom you wish people will stop believing.
One of my biggest pet peeves about people who are, call them like anti-libertarian, they think libertarianism is stupid. One of my biggest pet peeves is that, and this is extremely common, they falsely believe that libertarians claim that if we had a perfectly constructed libertarian society, that would be a utopia.
I heard it before.
I don't know why this is the case, other than possibly because communists and socialists, I think, would often claim that the perfect communist or perfect socialist society would be like a utopia. Mm-hmm. But I struggle to think of libertarians who claim that. The real claim is not that this fixes everything, but rather that it fixes the root from which a lot of these other poor decisions around how we construct society and governance operate, and that it's really more of a moral issue than it is an issue of trying to optimize for everybody's happiness and well-being and so forth. Though, if you were going down the anarcho-capitalist route, I believe you could make arguments that in general, people ought to be better off under a capitalist system simply because it allows for information to flow more freely. And by information, I'm really talking more about price. Price is like the ultimate piece of information. It's the ultimate signal for how an economy should be managed. And I think this blows a lot of people's minds because they think that complex systems need to be managed. But if you have something as complex as like a state or a country's economy, where you have millions, if not billions, of individual actors that are all interacting with each other, I think there is no way to centrally manage a system of that complexity. Rather, you have to allow for information, for the signal of pricing to be the thing that coordinates all of these independent actors. And like I said, that won't necessarily mean that like everybody is rich and successful and happy and at the top of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but it ought to be overall better off than what happens when you have like a single centralized entity mucking around in there. And like we've seen disastrous consequences of centralized control of economies, you know, causing things like massive starvation, for example.
Yeah. Which communication tools do you trust most and why?
A big fan of Signal. Less of a fan of WhatsApp. I don't use WhatsApp or any Meta-related platform, even though WhatsApp is end-to-end encrypted. You know, Meta's still getting your metadata and using that to effectively dox you or, you know, try to connect your activity on WhatsApp to other things that you're doing elsewhere on the internet. Graphene OS and Linux, you know, these are free open source software that is unfortunately more complicated to use than your like Windows or Mac, but you know, there's no spyware in them, which is nice.
I was going to ask you, a non-tech person can use Graphene?
I mean, you can. It's going to be more friction. You know, there are certain things, for example, you know, some common applications won't work well on Graphene OS because it's so hardened and prevents leaking of information. Like, especially one thing that I found is a lot of the rideshare apps, for example, are very invasive on like all of the sensor data, and they tend to want things like Google Play services available. And so, yeah, there are some apps that simply won't work on it. I actually have like a completely separate phone for doing like ride sharing apps just to keep it separate.
Let's zoom in on Nostra for a moment. What's Nostra and why should someone care about it?
Notes and other stuff transmitted by relays.
That already sounds so complicated.
Yeah, I mean, it's a protocol. It's a communication protocol. And so notes, basically meaning, you know, just snippets of text, which, you know, the first use case is social media. But because you can share notes and other digital content and files and stuff, people have built on Nostr as a protocol, as a platform to build all types of other functionality on top of, including stuff like, you know, podcasting, streaming services, you know, musical stuff, photo apps, only really limited by your imagination. And the nice thing is that it has cryptographic integrity checks and censorship resistance built in because there is no single point of failure. Because your identity is backed by cryptography, impersonation isn't really a thing. I mean, people can create another account and, you know, put your name on it and put your photo on it, but they'll never have your key to be able to actually cryptographically sign the things that you post to impersonate you from that perspective. It's a freedom technology, and because it's newer, it tends to be, once again, more friction and harder for people to use. But there's a number of applications and services out there that are continuing to work on the usability, the user friendliness.
Why does just another tweet miss the point?
Because it's not just the notes. Like one way that I like to think of Nostr is it's actually more of a decentralized identity protocol that you can then use to interact with other identities. So like there's some portability there in the sense that your identity on Nostr is just a cryptographic public key. And so if you start to build up, call it your web of trust, so to speak, maybe you do that using a standard, you know, Twitter-like clone to like find the people that you like, but then, you know, you can start interacting with them in other ways through other apps and services, but that identity is all portable, so you can start interacting with them, you know, between the same cryptographic keys, but with different features, functionality, media content, what have you.
These cryptographic public and private keys, mm-hmm. How do I secure them?
You know, it's analogous to your Bitcoin seed phrase. Mm-hmm. So not your keys, not your Nostr, I guess, is one way to look at it. So you definitely want to have backups of your private key. Otherwise, you lose your identity. You have to start all over again, which could be pretty annoying if you've, you know, built up a decent network and reach. So the downside, like from a security perspective, is that there are very, very few dedicated hardware devices that are analogous to like a Trezor for you to, you know, air gap your key. So, you know, most people, I think, have their private key either loaded into like a mobile app or possibly into like a web browser extension that is then doing the actual signing of these notes as you're creating them. And of course, that's problematic because it's kind of like having a hot wallet. So if your machine or that app gets compromised, then a bad actor could get access to those keys. Now, on the flip side, the nice thing is that it's not money. So like the incentives aren't quite the same. I'm not sure as an attacker, why would you want to get somebody's Nostr private key? Because it's probably not going to result in you getting any Bitcoin. Maybe you could impersonate them and then try to scam people to get Bitcoin, you know, through this extra hop. But we haven't really seen that happening too much yet. Though, of course, as it continues to grow and scale and more value is accrued to the network, then the incentives may change. When you have a Bitcoin wallet, the best practice is to never allow those keys to touch anything that touches the internet. So, you know, don't put them into your phone. Don't put them into your laptop. Only have them, you know, written down on a piece of paper or a metal plate or whatever, and then only load them into a dedicated hardware device like a Trezor, Ledger, Cold Card. I believe that Cold Card has started looking into some Nostr functionality. I'm not sure how far along they've gotten with it. There is something called a Nostr signing device, and I've set these up and played with them. But they're pretty nerdy. Like to actually set it up, you have to get this little, I think it's a Arduino board that you then have to like custom load firmware onto. Like,
so for now, I just store my private key on paper.
Yeah, the average Nostr user is probably going to have their private key like loaded into their browser or the mobile app that they're using.
Okay. What's the best and easiest way for people to onboard?
I think one of the biggest onboarding challenges is the discovery problem of, you know, how do you find other people on Nostr? It's this decentralized network. There was a website called Nostr.directory where people could kind of use it as a bridge to like link their Twitter profile to and say, you know, if you know me on Twitter, here's where you find me on Nostr. I think that Primal has done a fair amount of work on the discoverability problem. So I think Primal is probably one of the most adopted Nostr clients services out there.
What's your favorite client?
Well, I've been using Amethyst basically from day one, which is an Android app. on iOS, Damos is the most popular. I know that Damos is working on an Android version, though I'm not sure if it's like production ready yet. I haven't tried it.
What's your go-to metaphor for explaining a Nostra client to someone?
It's more like running a Bitcoin node than it is like running a Twitter app. Well, the main difference is that what are you connecting to in order to send and receive data? The overwhelming majority of apps that you run on your phone are connecting to one server that is operated by one company. And then, you know, there's a whole bunch of magical stuff going on behind the scenes. And that's what I've spent my entire career doing, is building software as a service, where you build incredibly complex software, but you shove all of that complexity behind a server that you can manage. And then you just push out a client for people to use that's really lightweight and is then connecting to the server that's doing all the heavy lifting. Rather, a Nostra client inverts that, where the client itself has to do all the heavy lifting and is reaching out not just to one, but to dozens and possibly hundreds of servers all over the world because the network is decentralized. And so you don't necessarily know, once again, that's kind of a discovery problem, but you know, where is everybody? Yeah. Putting their stuff on Nostra. There are ways, you know, there are parts of the standards of the protocol where you can basically put onto your profile that, like, hey, these are like the primary relays that I use. And so if you want to continually stay in touch with me, you should connect to these relays. There's like hints that you can put. Yeah, last I checked, like when Amethyst starts up by default, I think it connects to over 100, maybe 150 different popular Nostra relays.
If I have a Twitter account, what would I gain by opening a Nostra account just to do exactly the same thing that I'm doing over Twitter?
Well, the first reason of censorship resistance, I believe, was a far more compelling argument before Elon Musk took over.
Yeah.
But it's still an argument. Like, it's still quite possible for your X account to get axed, so to speak. If you're posting things that X doesn't like, that considers harmful or whatever against their terms of service, then bye-bye to your X account. And if you have a big account, you have a big following, big audience, you know, that can have a meaningful negative impact on you going forward. Yeah, on Nostra, on the other hand, I mean, you can't get deplatformed from Nostra the network. You could have like specific relays that decide to blacklist you. That's pretty rare.
What's a relay?
So the relay are the servers that mm-hmm. people are connecting to upload and download these notes and other things.
But there is always another relay that is going to publish your note.
Yeah, or you can run your own relay, and that's what I do. Mm-hmm. Of course, once again, probably only the nerdiest of people will do that. But I know that, you know, even if every other relay on the internet decides to block me for some reason, I'm not going to block myself from my own relay. And as long as I then allow other people to connect to my relay, then they can see my content.
And the same goes for clients. A client can cancel you.
Yeah, though that's not even really a thing. I mean, it does depend on the client, right? So if you're using like a web app client, it might be easier for them to block you. But like if you're using a mobile app, I think it's highly unlikely that the client will stop working for you, because the mobile app developer would have to actually implement something within the client to do that.
Let's see if I understand it correctly, because we've been suspended on X under Elon Musk. Mm. I think there are many Bitcoin accounts, tiny ones, that have been suspended.
Yeah.
And at the time, of course, I posted on Osta, and I thought, it's okay if Primal cancels me because I go with my content and my followers to Iris, or yeah, I can go to Damos and many more.
Yeah, you have censorship resistance due to a variety of things, but one of those is portability. And so this is actually one place where we went backwards over the history of the internet, is that originally one of the primary communications tools on the internet was email. The cool thing about email is, like, if you build an audience and you have a list of many people's email addresses, even if your current email provider decides to ban you, it's fine. You have the portability. You just go create an email account somewhere else and import that list, and now you can reach your audience again. When you get deplatformed from one of these centralized services that is not a protocol like email or Nostr, it's just a single company that built their own software and an infrastructure, there is no portability because it's not an open standard. If you get deplatformed from YouTube, there's no way to take, like, all of the names of your YouTube subscribers and put them into Rumble, for example. So that's another one of the benefits of Nostr, is portability, you know, both on the client side for you and on your audience side. Like, as long as you have the list of public keys of people that you're interacting with, you can reconnect with them.
Mm-hmm. What's your biggest doubt about Freedom Tech right now?
Mostly whether or not we'll be able to make it convenient enough that people will find the value proposition sufficient. As I've already said plenty of times, you know, human nature is to choose convenience at the expense of almost all else. And so I am not very bullish on being able to convince people, hey, you should do this because it's better for your privacy, security, freedom, what have you. If, for example, you look at, like, WhatsApp or Signal, if you actually look at, like, the stories of how they ended up getting adopted, yeah, sure, maybe the very, very early adopters did so because it had stronger privacy, but I think generally there were other reasons and incentives that led people to adopt it. I think you know, one of the reasons that WhatsApp got mass adopted was because it actually was cheaper for people in third world countries to use than SMS, for example.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about Telegram?
Yeah, generally I'm not a fan of Telegram because it's not private by default. This goes back once again to the earlier point when we were talking about privacy and defaults, is that I think a lot of people assume that it's private by default because they use some, like, privacy narratives, but group chats are never private. The default direct messages are not private unless you go taking some additional steps to create what's called a secret chat that is actually end-to-end encrypted. And even then, I believe that, like, the encryption algorithms and protocol that Telegram is using are not very well vetted. So the, you know, Signal protocol, I think, is much more verifiably robust than the Telegram encrypted chat.
Then why is Durov having so much trouble?
Well, I think he's having a lot of trouble actually because of it not being encrypted. Because probably 99% of Telegram conversations are not encrypted, that means that Telegram as an organization has the ability to see them and has the ability to work with law enforcement to reveal information to their investigations. And so if they don't comply in a expedient manner, that's when they start having problems. Now, Signal built their technology so that they literally cannot comply with a court order or warrant, or I mean, they do comply and they hand over all of the information that they have, which I believe is like the timestamp of the date that an account was created. I think that's about it.
Your deepest conviction about Freedom Tech?
That over the long term, over the course of human history, the adoption of freedom technology or lack thereof is going to have massive effects upon the trajectory of human civilization. And this is why, for example, we fought the crypto wars in the 1990s and we actually seem to be in like round two of fighting it today. And once again, let's think of the children, be afraid of the terrorists. We have to stop this activity. You have to give up your privacy as a result. Mm. And if we stop fighting that battle, I think that's when the world becomes more Orwellian, like 1984. That's an extreme example, but it's not outside the realm of possibility, where you have zero privacy and like literally every aspect of your life is controlled by government or some authority.
Who do you admire in the freedom tech world, but fundamentally disagree with?
Well, I don't know what you mean by fundamentally disagree with, but for example, I've already said multiple times I'm a big fan of Signal. Mm-hmm. And so, Moxie Marlin Spike, I think very reputable cypherpunk, but not a big fan of how they went about implementing money within Signal. It's like, why not just implement Bitcoin within Signal? Like, why do you have to come up with a new token?
A few final questions. Who or what do you watch closely?
As much as I hate it, I still watch the politicians pretty closely because they seem to be, in most cases, against our freedom. I mean, the politicians that I watch the closest would probably be the pro-freedom ones, like Thomas Massie. Big fan of his work. Ron Paul is great. Rand Paul, to a lesser extent, he's not quite as hardcore on the freedom aspects. But I think I watch Thomas Massie because he's a good signal where he's the one who's watching all of his peers. I don't want to have to watch all 400 and something members of Congress. Like, they're all doing stupid stuff all the time. But so he is a really good signal where, when his peers are doing something really stupid, then he blasts that out. But yeah, I mean, in general, I think the politicians and the governments are still our greatest threats.
Yeah. What worries you?
One thing that worries me at a very high level is it's analogous to what we've seen happen in America and probably, seen happen in many different nations throughout human history, because I also wonder if this is happening in Bitcoin. And that is basically when you found a new organization, whether it's a company or a country or a nonprofit or what have you. You start off and you have some guiding principles or a constitution or a white paper. And depending upon the strength of that founding document, I think that sets a course, that sets a trajectory for the evolution of that organization or that project over a long period of time. But it seems to me like almost no matter how well thought out or well intentioned the founding document is, there's no way to be comprehensive. And so what happens over the years, decades, and centuries after that founding document is that, the people who are then participating in that organization or that project then fight over interpretations of like, what did they actually mean by this? And so now, obviously, like if you look at the Constitution and the resulting behemoth of beast of a federal government and these, you know, hundreds of thousands of pages of codes and regulations and whatnot that have made our country much more difficult, I think, to operate within, at least from a freedom perspective. It makes me wonder if eventually that increasing complexity and fighting over the future of the system inevitably ultimately results in collapse of the system. I mean, I'm not aware of any country that has lasted forever, right? It's like, it seems like most countries, at least in modern times, most countries only last for a few hundred years. You know, there have been civilizations that have lasted thousands of years, but even great empires, it seems, always tend to collapse. To try to get this more analogous to Bitcoin, I think this mostly applies to my ossification concerns of Bitcoin, where it becomes harder and harder and harder to come to an agreement of how to keep moving forward and improving the protocol. Because, I mean, I think similar things happen with like the American government. As the game theory plays out, the incentives of the system have created this bipartisan system, and that has then created incentives for each party to become more and more polarized. And then as you have two polarized parties that go further and further apart from each other, it becomes harder and harder to come to consensus and agreement about anything. And I suspect the same thing will happen in Bitcoin. And then the question becomes, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Some people claim it's a good thing. I mean, it can be good in certain ways, but my claim is that it's ultimately potentially fatal, because if you can't change the system, then the system cannot react to changes in the environment outside of the system. And the world is going to continue changing. And if you, and maybe this is one of the reasons why countries and empires collapse, is because they're then unable to meet new challenges or meet changes in the environment that they're operating.
What scares you more, losing privacy or losing trust?
You mean other people losing trust in me?
For example.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely more worried about losing my privacy than like losing my reputation. Like I said, I'm at the point where if I wanted to, I could disappear tomorrow and I would be fine. Like I don't need to continue to leverage my reputation for my own benefit. I believe that I do it for the benefit of the greater liberty movement and privacy movement. But if I lose my privacy, then that's what once again puts me back at extreme physical risk, which I would prefer not to have to deal with.
What keeps you grounded?
Definitely the fact that I am constantly getting bombarded with contrary opinions of people who are telling me why I'm wrong about things.
And last one, what's one thing you wish Bitcoiners talked about more?
These days, I wish that Bitcoiners talked more about privacy and self-custody. One of the things that I really don't like about the past year or two in Bitcoin is that the dominant narrative seems to have become, you know, number go up. And once again, this is driving people towards convenience at the expense of their sovereignty. So, you know, it's great. We've got ETFs and now the boomers can get their paper Bitcoin IOUs. And you know, the theory is that TradFi, Rail, essentially drives more liquidity and value into Bitcoin. And so we all get richer as a result. I'm not sure that that has been the case so far, though, because like really, if you look at the exchange rate for the past year, we've gone pretty sideways. And so the institutions that are running these ETFs have hoovered up, I don't even know how many, like 100,000 Bitcoin at this point, and are centralizing it into the hands of a very small number of custodians, which is then creating an extreme level of systemic risk and fragility. So point being, we're almost asking to get goxed again at some point. And we're doing this in return for, you know, the promise of wealth that our Bitcoins will be worth more and that we will have, you know, more spending power. And all we have to do is do a deal with the central banker devils, basically, of letting them hold on to our Bitcoin for us.
But you think there's anything we can do?
I mean, you can't stop other people from using Bitcoin, right? So you can't. Bitcoin is for everyone. Bitcoin is for authoritarians, for dictators. Bitcoin is even for central bankers.
Yeah.
So that's why I think the appropriate reaction should not be, how do we stop them? Because you can't. But rather, what can we do to incentivize people not to use them and rather to go the more self-sovereign route? And that's one thing that I would argue that we've been doing at Casa for 8 years now, is we're trying to continue to make it more and more convenient and more, I would say, give people more peace of mind that they can take on the responsibility that comes with self-custody, because that is the trade-off of, you know, taking on the great power of self-custody, you know, the sovereignty that gives you. It comes with great responsibility. And I think that's what a lot of people are afraid of, mm-hmm. that they're going to screw something up. So we continue to make it more and more user-friendly so that people can actually have the confidence that they haven't screwed it up and that they can manage this responsibility at an individual level. You don't need to outsource the responsibility to a trusted third party the way that you do with many other aspects of your life.
Thanks again for your time and this generous conversation. I've learned a lot. Where can people find you and your work?
Well, I am on Nostr, but I couldn't tell you my InPub off the top of my head. Easiest place to find me is my website. It's just lopp.net, L-O-P-P.net.
It's been a pleasure having you on. I can't wait to have you back. Until then, stay sovereign. Thank you, Jameson.
Thanks for having me.